Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent challenge to share with you. This podcast is brought to you by the Ministry of Premier Insight. And on June 30th, we come to the end of our financial year. The challenge we face is there is a final funding gap of $65,000 that must be closed by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help meet this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the next hour and a half on the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate as part of Faith Explored. And you can find a vast back catalogue of programmes at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You'll find our podcast there, features, articles, videos and much more besides. And we're returning to the issue of biology, design, nature, stuff that we looked at last week. Had tons of feedback to last week's programme with Luke Jansen and Fuzz Rana, and we'll be getting to some of that towards the end of today's programme. Just a reminder, though, before we get into today's programme, that if you enjoy Unbelievable, you may enjoy the Unbelievable Conference on DVD and digital download. Still time to get it before Christmas if you'd like to give it to the loved one in your life who enjoys a bit of apologetics. Why not go to our website to find out more there? premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links to the Unbelievable DVD and digital download there. Straight after today's programme, on the profile, you'll hear Charmaine Noble-McLean talking to the Reverend Canon Philip Mount Stephen, head of the Church Mission Society. Right now, though, time to get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking, is design in nature undeniable? Doug Axe and Keith Fox are in debate today. Doug Axe is a molecular biologist and director of the Biologic Institute. And for several years, he's been a significant voice in the intelligent design community. His new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed, charts his own journey as a, you could say, rebel researcher in Cambridge who insisted that his work on the nature of the molecular systems in the cell defied standard evolutionary ways of looking at things. He's in conversation about the book today with Keith Fox, Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Southampton. Keith is also Associate Director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge, which works to show the complementarity of evolution and Christian faith. Both Doug and Keith are Christians, but they take very different views on whether biology confirms or contradicts Darwinian evolution. Keith could be described as a theistic evolutionist. He thinks that intelligent design is a bit of a misguided venture. Well, they're going to be discussing the book and Doug's view of what he calls common science, that biology confirms what we suspected all along, that life is designed. Welcome along to the programme, both Keith and Doug. Great to have you with me.
Great to be here.
Good to be here. Thank you, Justin.
It's great to have you. And Keith, you've been on the programme before. We'll come to you in a moment for a little update on what's happened in the intervening years, I think, since you were last on. But Doug, first time on the programme today.
So yes.
You've come across the pond. You've been involved in a recent conference in Cambridge. And also, I believe, we're attending a Royal Society event here in the UK.
Yes, that's correct.
Discussing, yeah, I think, issues that are pertinent to what we're talking about today. Do you want to briefly recap what that was about?
Yeah, it was called New Trends in Evolutionary Biology, a three-day conference held by the Royal Society, convened by the Royal Society. I was there not expecting that my take on this would be represented at all, and I didn't attempt to force it on anyone. It was more kind of an in-house conversation among members of the evolutionary biology community as to whether sort of the more trendy aspects of this field deserve to be called a new theory or to displace or extend what's called the modern synthesis. So the sort of the standard classical neo-Darwinian theory. And a lot more friction than I anticipated actually between these two camps.
I guess science has always, in a sense, not been just a kind of purely sort of rational, logical endeavor. People invest themselves into certain views, don't they?
Yes.
And it takes a lot to persuade someone out of views sometimes.
Certainly. So you see all the human elements present in science. You see egos, you see politics, you see, you know, all the things you see in business and everywhere else you see in the scientific community.
It's not exempt from that. I mean, obviously, this comes into the book that you've written, Undeniable. The title, I think, a little bit of a play on another famous science man who's written a book called Undeniable, Bill Nye, the science guy. Did you purposely decide to mimic the title?
I didn't, actually. Well, at least in the first instance, actually, one of I have two daughters, and one of my daughters came up with Undeniable as a one-word title, and I thought, that's nice, a one-word title. Mm. Of course, you Google a title when it's been proposed, and that's when I saw Bill Nye's book. And at that point, I thought I probably shouldn't use Undeniable, but in further conversation, people said, you know, it might be good to actually invite the comparison. Yeah. So that's the way I ended
because Bill Nye, for those who aren't familiar, it is a well-known proponent of evolution and so on in the States, and his book sort of, in a sense, saying almost exactly the opposite to what yours is.
Right.
Hey, might be fun to get you guys in a discussion at some point, but we're looking forward to the discussion with Keith today. But before we go to Keith, just if you could summarize, as you tell it in the book, your story, because you've been working at a pretty high level for much of your life in researching molecular systems.
Yes.
But it's landed you at odds with many of your colleagues, your scientific colleagues in this area. Do you want to just spell out some of what happened?
Sure. So I actually came to the UK to do a postdoc and landed at the Department of Chemistry in Cambridge. And I was moving from engineering to molecular biology, intending to examine critically whether the Darwinian mechanism can invent new things at the molecular level. So in particular, it was proteins that I was interested in particular. Mm. So that set me off on what ended up being a multi-decade study of whether random mutation and natural selection can produce new proteins, new enzymes in particular, proteins that do chemistry. And after working on that for a long time and involving others in the work, I believe I came to the point where I could say quite conclusively that it doesn't work, that you can't actually solve this information problem in the Darwinian way. Had an opportunity to write a book and had to decide how to go about writing the book. And I decided against simply trying to simplify technical work and distill it for a non-technical reader. I wanted to reach a large audience, so I didn't want to be writing just for scientists. I decided instead to cast the entire argument around things that are more more common and more intuitive and more comfortable for your average reader without, I think, diminishing the power of the argument. So I ended up framing it around an intuition that's widely acknowledged that we all have, and it's the design intuition. From an early age, we look at living things and we recognize that they were made by a godlike designer, as it's been acknowledged.
I mean, a lot of people who, when I do intelligent design debates on the show, get in touch to say, look, if there really was anything in intelligent design, we'd be seeing it in the well-argued papers in the scientific literature. And they might turn around and say to you, Doug, the fact you've produced a book that's essentially aimed at a popular level audience shows that you haven't actually got the arguments you need to get it into the scientific literature.
Well, it is not just a popular level. So I decided that I would build the book around something that I call common science. So the sort of science that we all do that's intuitive, it's well connected to everyday experience so that everyone gets it. But I do fold in the technical science in a simple way. So for 25 years, I've been doing the technical science, not the simple stuff. I just didn't want to be in a position of merely simplifying technical work, because then I knew, of course, that the people who disagree with what I'm saying would give their simplification of a critique, and it would leave people who aren't scientists in a position of not knowing who to believe. And I feel as though fundamentally this isn't a technical argument. It's a common sense and common science argument.
But have you been able to, if you like, be able to do a peer-reviewed paper?
Many. Kind of, yes. So,
and have they been willing to be published, you know, in reputable scientific journals?
Yes. Now, there was a point where, so some of the key work is published in mainstream peer-reviewed scientific journals. There was a point where it became more and more clear what I was saying, and there was a point where I was effectively blacklisted, and even journals that had published our work a year ago, we submit again, and they wouldn't even send it out for a peer review. They would just send it right back. So there was a point where it became much harder to publish in the usual way. What I did at that point is I had enough experience and knew enough colleagues who were also interested in doing work in this area that we started a new journal. So we have an online journal called Biocomplexity.
Right. I mean, this is kind of woven into the story, obviously, that you tell in the book of your personal journey, which included the fact that your own position of research came under pressure while you were at Cambridge, and you effectively had to step out of the department you were in and were taken under the wing of another part of the university. Do you want to just summarize that?
Yeah, so this was back in 2002. Things got particularly tense here in Great Britain over intelligent design, and it had been relatively quiet before that. A lot of tension in the U.S. There were schools that were teaching intelligent design along with evolution at that time, or in the years prior to that. It became very controversial, was debated in the House of Commons, all over the news in 2002. A number of events in the lab where I was were also causing tension. There had been a retracted, high-profile Nature paper on evolution. All these events kind of came together and made for a very tense climate where I was working. And in the end, the director there, Sir Alan First, had me removed in March of 2002.
Because they didn't like the kinds of conclusions you believed your research was pointing to?
Well, I actually quote from the email. So I didn't get direct contact from Alan, as I know him. I got an email from his assistant who said, we have very limited space and we need you to vacate within 2 weeks. So end of March 2002. Now, that was a very strange thing to say.
Right.
There were a lot of people working there. There was no particular change in the space situation, and I was the one person asked to leave. So it looked very much to me as though Alan didn't want to, and beside that, I had been there longer than anyone else.
Sure.
And he didn't come and actually explain the situation to me. He seemed to be avoiding me. So I could tell immediately that based on my prior conversations with him, I knew that he was getting very tense about this whole thing that was boiling over, and that my days were probably numbered.
You were allowed to finish your research effectively by another route in Cambridge, and that was with the help, I know, of Dennis Alexander and so on. But the Dennis Alexander's been on the show before, but Keith Fox joins me on the program today, who knows Dennis well, because Keith is actually the Associate Director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge, which, of course, Dennis Alexander was up until recently the director of. Thank you for joining us on the show today, Keith.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you on. These are, of course, controversial issues, and especially when it comes to relationships and politics and that kind of thing within the scientific community. You've had a chance to briefly look yourself at the book, and we're going to be talking about the science and the theological implications as we go along. To what extent do you think, though, there is a kind of a consensus, a sort of barricades that get built up against these kinds of views that might challenge the prevailing orthodoxy in science? Do you think that that's overplayed by people like Doug and the intelligent design community?
I think it is overplayed. There is obviously always a consensus in science. It's done by people, and in the same way as any other discipline, we're talking law or business, then there are disputes between people and with different ideas. But science is something that is self-correcting, maybe over generations. It's the sort of thing that people come up with hypotheses, they test them out. Some survive the test of time, many don't. So I think there's an openness in science to at least look at data. How you interpret the data is that can vary from time to time. But I don't see scientists as being closed to actually looking at the data that's in front of them.
I mean, just briefly, you have had a long career now looking at the very same kind of biochemical systems that Doug looks at. You've come to very different conclusions, both in your Christian faith and as a scientist, about the nature of them. So what for you, kind of in a nutshell, kind of brings you to such a different place to Doug?
I mean, my own story is having been through as a chemist and then a biochemist, so coming from the more physical sciences background into biology, of seeing the wonderful complexity of the world that we live in biological terms, and being fascinated by that, and yet seeing at the same time that there was a coherence and a rationality to the way in which things are put together. There is, in evolutionary terms, there is similarities between different organisms, between their biochemistry and their structures. And for me, as a Christian who believes in a God who is the ultimate creator and originator and sustainer of this world, I can see his handiwork in those rational chemical, biochemical processes.
But obviously not in quite the same sense that you would see a sort of a requirement that something beyond just the laws of nature, which presumably you believe God instituted.
Absolutely.
In that sense. I mean, we'll come to the theological side of this in due course. But I think we need to spell out, for the sake of those listening, what the science is that Doug is claiming here. And we'll do that in a moment's time. I want to make sure there's plenty of opportunity for listeners of the show, because these sorts of subjects always get people picking up the phone or, well, at least typing in an email. unbelievable@premier.org.uk if you'd like to send me an email with your thoughts about what we're talking on today. You can, of course, also get in touch via the Facebook and Twitter account @unbelievablejb to send me a note via Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want to follow the show on Facebook, and leave me your thoughts that way as well. Don't forget that today's guest links to Doug's book and where you can find out more about Keith from the programme online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, we're asking today, is design in nature undeniable? Undeniable, the name of the new book by Doug Axe. He's a molecular biologist joining me on the show today to explain why he believes that when you look at the molecular systems in the cell, they do defy a standard evolutionary story. You've spelled out very briefly some of the issues you had at an academic level. Let's talk a little bit about the science. First of all, you introduced this term common science, which is sort of a play on the word common sense, obviously. Right. Doug, what's this common science that you like to talk about in the book?
Well, I think it goes all the way back to our infancy, really. We start off life exploring the world. Anyone who's been a parent and raised a child has seen how you move through these steps of physical experimentation with your own body, with things that you manipulate, learning balance, learning how to crawl, learning how to walk, that kind of thing. In all of this, we're really doing an exercise of observation, data collection, and modeling. And of course, we don't use those terms. We don't think of it in that way. But we do have these mental models that we build about how the world works. And with this experimentation, which is really through play in the early years, we're really modifying these models with new data. So that really is, it's a scientific exercise. Mm. So I know people don't think of that as scientific and they don't think of themselves as being scientists, but I argue in the book that really in that simple way, we all do science, and science is quite familiar and it shouldn't be threatening. And I use that to just pave the way to make an argument in a non-threatening way that people can grasp.
And you go on to talk about the universal design intuition. What
right.
is that? Because often in life, our intuitions don't always turn out to be true.
That's correct. This one, I think, does turn out to be true. And I had actually started the book and was framing the book around the intuition, when I came across a beautiful quote by UC Berkeley psychology professor Allison Gopnik that I put in the book. Early on, I'm going to read what she wrote. She said, by elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them, even children brought up as atheists. So there's this, and she's not the only one who's acknowledging. In fact, she was referring to the work of Deborah Kellerman, another psychology professor. This is why they acknowledge that it does not seem to depend on the home culture. So the parents could be atheists, bring up children that they intend to be atheists. Mm-hmm. And yet, at this early age, when we look at butterflies, we see them as something made by a godlike designer. So that's very interesting. I thought the fact that it's universal and the fact that we all have it, this is something that I could touch on and show that even though many of these people will, by a certain age, learn to or try to suppress that intuition and say that it's not, that this is one of those intuitions that's false, it is a starting point to make an argument.
Yeah, and many in the scientific community would say, well, yes, of course, that's the natural
sure.
thing to think. That's what everyone thought before Darwin came along, and he showed them that their intuitions were, in fact, had fooled them were false. I mean, but your point is, as obviously the book title says, you think actually biology is confirming, after all, that intuition that life is designed.
Yes, and I don't want to imply that the intuition is an argument. The intuition is not an argument. Mm. It's something that we come to very quickly, immediately. We don't feel as though we're rationalizing our way to this. It's an almost an instantaneous conclusion we come to. But I argue that it is actually true if you look at it and you look at the basis
We'll come next to the science, obviously, and spell that out briefly. Just though first, Keith, do you broadly agree that most people do seem to have or are born with or very quickly develop this intuition for design in the world they see around them?
Perhaps I could pick up a couple of points from that. I mean, I'm delighted that Doug sees everybody as practicing science, because that's what we do day to day. And the professional scientists will take that down to a different level of complexity. I am slightly concerned about the word intuition, because there are plenty of things that children think by intuition that we know are wrong. So the sun rising and the setting, the moon doing so. The fact that the objects we see in front of you are not actually that solid. Most of them are vacant space if we look at it in terms of atomic structure. So intuition can be helpful, but we need to be very careful the way we use it. Similarly, with the idea of design, I think you're quite right that children do seem to have an innate belief in God as the originator, the designer of things. I think Justin Barrett has done quite a considerable amount of work with that with children. But the design aspect of that, I'm less comfortable about. If you ask a child, why is a flower colored, they'll say, well, it's to make it pretty, maybe, so that I can enjoy it. That's a form of teleological argument that I'm not comfortable with. There are other biological reasons why the flower might be colored, so as to attract other insects, etc. So intuition, we've got to be very careful in the way we use that.
Yeah, do you want to respond on that?
Well, I totally agree. In other words, I would not write a book saying kids think this is true, therefore it's true. What I'm trying to do is say this is a point of contact where even an atheist or a hard-bitten materialist, even Richard Dawkins, should concede that this is there, and then I build a book from that. That's the starting point of the book. Sure. It's not the conclusion.
I mean that's quite true. We all use the word design, but we use it in different settings. So even Dawkins can't resist using that word, but then qualifies that as to what he means by design, without necessarily, in his case, invoking a designer. Now, I would invoke a designer with a small d who's involved in much more than just the intricacies of the biological processes. Any Christian would, I hope, say that God was the creator and the designer of everything. It's just what we mean when we use those words.
Well, look, let's talk about the science, and we'll probably do that until we come to our break, and then we'll give Keith a chance to respond to it. Because, as the title says, you believe that intuition is confirmed in the end by what we actually measure. You particularly, obviously, have spent a lot of your life looking at the proteins, and in particular how they form enzymes and those sorts of things, and what the proteins themselves are made up of, and how whether that could be explained by a, if you like, non-directed evolutionary process.
Right.
So as ever, and you've only got 5 minutes here, you've got to keep this as simple as possible for the likes of us who haven't done a PhD. But yeah, take us through what your research showed you.
Well, can I say first that the book has a layer between pointing out the design intuition and then talking about proteins. And that's this common science layer where I actually take things that are more familiar than proteins and show that these things can't happen by accident. So I look at a number of things in the book, like written instructions, the pixels that form a photograph, things that are more familiar than proteins, and I make an argument based on those. Once I've made that argument, then I introduce, well, I have introduced proteins, but I come back to proteins and say the things of life are like writing, only more so. So the things that were true of writing are true of the things of life. So proteins, which both Keith and I think work on, are these long strings, sort of like a pearl necklace, except you have 20 different kinds of pearls that get arranged into a string based on the genetic instructions in the gene.
And those pearls are the amino acids.
Those are the amino acids.
Form a protein.
Correct. Yeah. The 20 different common naturally occurring amino acids get strung up in sequence. And it turns out that the properties of the sequence are very important for what this thing does. So if you just randomly strung them together, you would get a floppy chain that would get chopped up inside a cell, and then it would recycle the amino acids. But if it has an appropriate sequence to it, the chain collapses on itself and forms a very specific, stable, three-dimensional structure that does things.
And you describe it in the book as that proteins are a bit like the different parts of a car that you might find in, but this
yes.
time in a cell. They've got particular purposes. They're doing particular jobs.
Right. So a cell is a big thing compared to a protein molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And the tasks within the cell, for the most part, the major tasks are orchestrated and performed by typically not just single proteins, but protein complexes.
And these protein complexes, they've got very specific shapes that help them
right.
to do the jobs that they're meant to do, and the chemical reactions that they're catalyzing and so on within the cell. And now, what was the point of this? Because your research was aimed at showing that whether these, you could build a protein effectively by a sort of a reasonably random process, if you like. If you swapped out amino acids, would it change the way the protein worked effectively? And what you found is, no, it completely ruins the protein.
Yeah, so actually at the time that I was removed from the Medical Research Council Center, back in 2002, I had started a project where I was trying to find out what fraction, suppose you did randomly string these together like the necklace, what fraction of those strings would you expect to fold to the sort of structure that can perform biological functions? And that was an experimental project that I ended up finishing at the Babram Institute, thanks to Dennis Alexander, a mutual friend of mine and Keith's, and came up with a number based on experimental data that was a very sort of surprisingly small number, I think, for a lot of people, but it does tie in with other experimental results at the time. Something like one in a trillion, 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 trillion of these sequences would be expected to fold to the sort of structure, a native-like structure that could perform a enzyme or structural protein function in a cell.
And the outcome of that is the idea that these proteins were produced in a way that where they weren't intended to have these kinds of functions seems almost incomprehensible mathematically to you.
Correct. So the way I put the question is, can accidental causes come up with something that's that rare? And I didn't say actually in the paper where this was reported, this was a Journal of Molecular Biology paper that came out in 2004. I didn't say, therefore, proteins could not have evolved, but I did end the discussion saying, this raises a question about how you would hit such a small target.
Mm. Which was enough to obviously set off some alarm bells with...
Well, the paper was published. It was late. I think you can say something. You can get away with saying some things that push the envelope a little bit. But when it becomes clear that you are challenging the orthodoxy, then I think it becomes harder and harder.
Okay. We'll talk a bit more about proteins and amino acids in a minute, because I'm sure Keith will want to respond on this. And maybe just to sketch it out a little bit more as well, because I think people will still be wondering, okay, what are these amino acids? What difference does it make? And so on. You're listening to a scientific edition of Unbelievable today. We like to do science, done quite a lot of science in the second half of this year. Doug Axe joins me, molecular biologist and director of the Biologic Institute. His new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed, charts his own journey as a bit of a rebel researcher in Cambridge and why he believes that biological systems do show that life has some kind of purpose design built in to these systems. Keith Fox also joins me, and he's going to be responding in a moment. Keith's a professor of biochemistry at the University of Southampton, and he's going to be explaining why, as a Christian, he believes in a creator God, but not one that dabbles and influences and tinkers with the biological systems in the way that Doug's describing. So come back again in a short moment's time for the rest of this week's Unbelievable. Is your tinsel looking tired? Does your nativity need a new lease of life? Then do not fear. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we've 101 fresh ideas for Christmas in your church. Okay, it's about 27 really. But you'll also find amazing stories of near-death experiences, why culture is turning against porn, and how you can make sure your pastor doesn't burn out. All that plus much more. Request a free sample copy of the December magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show, Unbelievable, brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. I'm the editor, and if you want to get hold of a free sample copy, can I remind you to go to premierchristianity.com/freesample. And all part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. If you want more shows, particularly if you're interested in more shows on intelligent design, science and those kinds of debates, we've done so many of them over the years, and you can look through the archives and find them at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to my two guests joining me on today's programme, Doug Axe and Keith Fox. We'll certainly be hearing some of your thoughts on this, I'm sure, in the future. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll get time for some feedback towards the end of today's show as well. Don't forget that straight after Unbelievable today, you can hear The Profile between 4 and 5, another significant Christian talking about their life and faith journey. But back into today's conversation, let's hear from Keith now. Keith is a professor of biochemistry at the University of Southampton and associate director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge. As you've already spelled out, Keith, you're a Christian, but you obviously don't see the need to invoke sort of design needs in this particular way, in the functions of the cell and so on. I'm sure you're as intrigued by the way that these proteins are formed and their complexity as Doug is. Do you disagree fundamentally with what he's seen, what he believes he's seen through his research about the incredibly complex nature of the proteins and what happens when you just ever so slightly tweak them, that they seem to lose all the functionality that they once had?
No, I don't fundamentally disagree. Proteins are extremely complicated. They're complex. The way they fold together is very, very precise. But I take issue with Doug over a few things. He talks as if biology is goal-directed, as though biology is inventing things, whereas actually biology is more discovering things. It's an opportunistic process of whatever works is used and improved upon, rather than biology necessarily seeking out to how can it find a problem, an answer to a problem. So that's one way in which I think I would want to disagree with Doug. The other thing is that over the millions of years of evolution, the sorts of proteins we have now are very, very finely tweaked. Changing them is inevitably going to have disastrous effects. It's rather like, I suppose, the analogy of cars. An old-fashioned motor car, you could lift the bonnet, you could get in, you could tinker with it, you could do all sorts of things. You try and do that with a modern automobile, lift the bonnet, and there's nothing there to see because it's so precisely engineered. And I think that's the same way with some of the proteins that we look at. Proteins that Doug's described are enzymes. Enzymes are catalysts. They simply speed up the rates of reactions that would occur at a very, very low rate anyway. And these things now are working at millions of times the rates that they would do naturally. And they're very, very precise. Now, over evolutionary time, archetypal ones may have only speeded up by twofold, fourfold, tenfold, and by today's standards, they would be hopeless. But those incremental steps over an evolutionary time have led to things now that are very, very precise. And then, therefore, you can't move between enzyme A and enzyme B because each is very precisely engineered. Each of those may have had a parent originator enzyme from which both are descended. But you'd have to go back to the original one before you could then convert A to B. You'd have to go back to form X that was present many millennia ago. So the whole system is very, very complicated, but I don't see the need to say it's so complicated we have to invoke a designer who has been engineering and tinkering at the molecular detail. So biology discovers, it's a kind of haphazard process in which things are found to be useful and they're used.
And in that sense, it's just adapting what it finds. And over time, that builds you something quite complex. But it's not in that sense as though these things all came together in one go, as we find them in our bodies today, is what you're saying there, Keith.
Absolutely. And biology is very resourceful. In the same way as when I do DIY, I've never got the right piece, never got the right tools that I need for it. I just find something at the toolbox
right,
that makes do.
Sure, yeah.
And that's what biology does. And over time, yeah, we'll then hone that instrument that maybe isn't perfect, but just does the job.
I mean, that's frequently the answer I've heard as well to other people like Michael Behe as well, Doug, who have claimed a kind of irreducible complexity of certain features of bacteria like the, you know, the flagellum and so on. This is the way evolution works. You know, it's piecemeal. It sorts things out. Some things don't work, some things do. But eventually you do build what look on the face of it like incredibly complex, perhaps even designed things. But it's your intuition's wrong on that one, basically, Doug. So how do you answer that?
Okay. Well, Keith said that biology discovers things. And if we come back to common science, so when we discover things, if we imagine not purposefully, because I think Keith said that as well, that it's not setting out to discover things, it finds things. And I talk about this in the book. If we imagine being blindfolded and wandering around and having some buried treasure or something that we could potentially find by stumbling upon it, suppose we're poking the ground with a rod, and if it hits metal, then we dig away the dirt and we find a buried treasure. It's reasonable to ask, what is the likelihood, or how long would we have to wander? How many of us would have to wander in order to find such a treasure? And the answer to that is it depends on how big the ground is over which we're wandering and how large and how many caches of treasure there are in the ground. So you can put numbers on this. Discovery in this sense, the sense of stumbling upon something, is only possible if the number of things that are wandering is large enough and the space is small enough and the number of things to be discovered is large enough that it can happen by accident. This is where the numbers come in, and the numbers do not work for Darwinism. If something is one in a trillion, 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 trillion rare, then it won't be discovered this way. So that is the argument. I know that Keith's view is the common one, and this is the widely held view that biology is opportunistic, that evolutionary is opportunistic. It's not an intentional inventor. It comes upon things and then it uses them. I'm saying these things are too rare to come upon. They can't be had that way.
Keith, do you want to respond?
My point is that the fully functional proteins with the sort of activities we see today, your analogy is entirely correct, but that's not how they've arisen. They've come through something that was just a little bit better and then improved upon that. That's the one thing that just looking at a landscape and saying, can I find a piece of gold or buried treasure? Either it is or it isn't, whereas biology is something that improves on things, that there's a development over time.
Are you saying these proteins would have had different functions? And then the function changed as something else.
Either they would have had different functions, or they would have had much less efficient functions than we've got now. Things that would have maybe only speeded process up by a tiny amount compared with a millionfold. And so it's a stepwise improvement over time as things get better, not by just discovering something new, but by improving on what's already there.
Why doesn't that work mathematically for you?
Well, and as you know, Keith, it can be far more than a millionfold. It can be a million millionfold for these catalytic processes, or more than that. So we did an actual experiment like this that I think touches on what Keith is saying. I'm very open to being shown that this works. First of all, I want to say I am open to evidence that will show me to be wrong. I want to say that up front.
Okay.
Here's an experiment that we did. We had two protein molecules, both of which confer resistance to penicillin antibiotics in bacteria. So you give the bacteria a gene for this, and if you plate them on agar trays, if you put them on petri dishes with a little bit of penicillin, the bacteria can form colonies because they can break down the penicillin. One of these was a folded version of a natural enzyme that breaks down penicillin, but it had been beaten up with mutations, so it was very inefficient. So exactly what Keith was talking about, very, very low degree of activity. The other one wasn't even folded. It was derived from a beta-lactamase, the natural enzyme, but a large chunk was deleted and a bunch of point mutations were introduced. So this thing was badly, badly ruined. But it still has a slight catalytic activity against penicillin antibiotics. Both of them, in terms of their effect, are very similar. And we did rounds of mutation and selection on both of these in parallel to see what would happen. In the one case, the case where you have a folded complete enzyme that's very poor function, it did exactly what Keith is saying. It improved remarkably, over 500 fold. So we got something that was actually better than the natural beta-lactamase. In the other case where it was not even an enzyme, it was a botched thing that wasn't even folding, was performing low-level catalysis the way simple acids and bases can do. You go through the same process of mutation and selection, and it goes nowhere. So what I would say in response to Keith is, you need something there that is invented, and that is the one in a trillion, 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 trillion thing before you can improve to the level of an enzyme. You can't get that from nothing.
Yeah, I think I follow you there. But Keith, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd come back on that. There are a number of examples that are used in molecular biology. For instance, you know, directed evolution is a commonly applied approach. My own discipline, rather than proteins, is nucleic acids and CELEX for taking random sequences of nucleic acids that can fold and just picking out the one molecule that has a particular binding or enzyme activity within that. We know you can take a mixture of random things and pull out something with very low frequency, but it can be done. It's frequently practiced in laboratories. So I can't talk about the specifics of your particular beta-lactamase enzyme, but the principle is one that is frequently applied in molecular biology labs.
Yes, I quote some of the key... one of the people who is a key user of that method, the directed evolution method, is saying, we've become very good at making bad enzymes, but to make good enzymes will take a completely different method or new insight altogether. So it's recognized in that field that what you get when you do these things, when you start with random sequences and try to pull out, or even not random, you start with something that is partly designed and then you add a random component to it to try to get a new function, you don't end up getting things that are comparable to these marvelous things that we see in life. And that's being acknowledged by people.
But isn't the whole point that Keith's making that, okay, in your lab, you won't see that happen, but in the vast stretches of time we're talking about for evolution, with so many goes, with so many attempts, with so many, you know, with the wide diversity of...
Why should we believe that just as a story? Okay, that's being told as a story, and I agree that is the orthodox story. What I think should happen is these people who say they believe that should go in the lab and show me why I should believe that. And so far, I've not seen that.
Right. Is that an assumption we just have to take on faith in that sense, Keith, that really it would work if we had the same conditions that Earth has experienced over the last several millennia?
And partly it's same conditions. It's also the time factor. I mean, so we're talking about not just something taking place in a laboratory over a couple of weeks, but something taking place in nature over millions of years. I mean, the sheer number of molecules is something that is absolutely astounding. So, a liter of water contains 10 to the 25 molecules of water. That's one with 25 zeros after it. Now, that's a very simple compound, but if you take a mixture of different amino acids, how many different ways of putting those together so as to achieve something that at least has a basic primitive property that can then be improved on in biology? So I still take issue with what Doug is saying, that these things over large periods of time can be improved upon.
I say you are recounting for me a story. And I think a story can be a good starting point for doing science. But what I would want to see is someone who takes that story seriously enough that they go into the lab and do the work that shows me how it actually works.
How could you show that, though, in the sense that you don't have millions of years at your disposal?
Yeah, you don't need that. You can do the math of population genetics and show Based on what you observe in the lab, actual data, you can then use the math of population genetics to say, given what we've measured now and what we've seen, how long would it take for this to happen in the wild, in a wild population?
And because you can't even get a starting point in the lab means you're not going to see anything happen.
Or if you engineer and do get a starting point, you can say, what did I need to get here? How long would it take for the Darwinian process to get here? So instead of just throwing up our hands and telling stories, we should be...
I mean, some people are willing to say, okay, you've tossed a very big number into the equation there, Doug, but we live in a very large universe with all kinds of other possible life-bearing planets. You know, when you look at it on that scale, yeah, it seems incredibly unlikely, but hey, we're the one planet in the whole universe where...
You certainly have to take the actual size of the real problem into account. So that involves very large numbers of organisms over a very large time, but it's not infinite. So there are limits to these things. And that's why you have to do the math of population genetics. But I say you get real data, apply real math to it, and you answer the question definitively instead of just saying, this is what everyone says, so I'll accept
it. Does the size of the universe make any difference in that sense to the mathematics we're talking about?
It does. And of course, people are now talking about a multiverse. So you could say, if it doesn't work in our universe, what if you have an infinite number of universes? I touch on this in the book, and I actually argue that the multiverse hypothesis, whatever you think about it, it does not solve this problem.
Right.
The problem with the maths, if I can come in here,
is
you can only mathematically model something if you've got a model, and that in itself makes some assumptions. Maybe there are processes going on that we can't begin to think about what they are at the moment. And so the maths is limited in what it could predict.
What I'm not talking about is having a mathematical model of, say, protein folding. I'm talking about having a mathematical model of the basic Darwinian process, where you have a population, you have every individual in the population has a potential for receiving a mutation that brings about a sequence that has a new function. That new function can or may not be of selective benefit. There's a number you can put on the selective benefit, and then you can do the math to say how long would it take for this thing to produce something that sweeps through the population and becomes fixed. And to answer that, you don't have to model how frequent the beneficial sequences are. You can take that number from what you got in the lab and say, if this number is correct, how long will it take to get something like this in a natural population? Or you can say, leave it as an open model, and we've published this, and say, suppose you can get something beneficial in one mutation, how long would it take? What if it takes two mutations, three mutations, four mutations?
I want to move us on to the theological issues. But Keith, I think what Doug's essentially saying is you can extrapolate from what we do in the lab to say, what would that look like in the real world? What would you have to make this happen? I mean, do you just have a problem that we just can't really know exactly what would it actually happen in the real world scenario?
I think that's the problem, is that Doug's maths is fine as far as it goes, but that's within the lab. And what happens in a real-world scenario where you don't know the steps along the way, the process that you've gone through, which routes do you take to get to something that's highly complicated? And it may well go through transitions that we're just not imagining at the moment.
Part of me wonders, is there any level of complexity at which point you would say, okay, Doug, you've got a point, this does look designed now? Or is design just never going to be an option, no matter how much things look incredibly like the maths is against them ever developing in that way?
And I would always want to go back into the lab and actually say, is there anything I can do to begin to answer why is that so complicated? Can I think of a way of explaining the way things are? Now, biology is complicated. It's the world we live in is very complex. But I don't think that stops the scientists from saying, now, can I work out a mechanism for how this might have come together?
So you'd always prefer, in that sense, a naturalistic explanation?
I'd always prefer a scientific, I don't like the word naturalistic,
okay,
a scientific explanation that says, how could this come to be? Otherwise, we're coming to a science stopper. We say to the scientists, oh, this is just too complicated, forget it.
Well, now we've opened up, I guess, the scientists
will always say, I want to know. Maybe I never will find out, but at least I'll go away.
Is it possible to use science to show that something can't happen? I would say yes, right? Can a cheetah run at two times the speed of light? There are all kinds of things that you can say definitively, experimentally, that say this can't happen and this is why it can't happen. So
in science, I'm reluctant to never say never, as they say.
If you're
talking about probabilities, but sorry,
if science can show anything definitively, then it's showing the not of that definitively to be false, right? So it is saying never. If you can say that mass is conserved, then you're saying that mass is never not conserved. If you're saying that E equals mc squared, you're saying E never doesn't equal mc squared. So all of these things that we do in science, if we come to any conclusion at all, we're ruling out the alternatives to those conclusions.
And that's very true in the examples you've just given in terms of physical laws. But in terms of extrapolating back to mechanisms, I don't think we can ever say that you can never show that. And say it might be complicated. I don't understand at the moment. I'll look for a way to see if we come through. Maybe I never will. But
I think what Doug's saying is it's going to be hard for him to ever disconfirm your view then, Keith, because you'll never accept anything that looks like design, which is kind of has to be the alternative to non-directed Darwinian evolution.
Yes, and I always want to leave the thing open for the scientists to come back and say that if you accept design and say something cannot have evolved, then actually that's saying to the scientists, just stop. Don't ask any more questions. It's finished.
God, is it saying, is it a science stopper? This is a frequent thing that's thrown at people.
Not at all. What I'm saying is science can say things definitively. I think here's where I would agree with Keith. I believe you can show that accidental causes are not adequate for certain effects, and I believe we've shown that for life. Now, where I would agree with Keith is that doesn't rule out other causes. Mm. There could be something other than what I've ruled out that does explain this, and that is the design. That's where you come to the design inference. So in that respect, and I know Keith won't buy that as the as the alternative, but I believe that is where the logic that Keith is referring to is validly applied.
I mean, do you think we're basically, Keith, got, you know, with evolutionary theory, even though we might tweak at it and, you know, we might sort of change bits and pieces, fundamentally, that paradigm is never going to change. That's a fact now, and it's not going to be overturned by any future discoveries.
I'll never say never again, but because science is always self-assessing and self-criticizing. But I think the way I see it at the moment, it is supported by such a weight of evidence from all kinds of different disciplines of evolution itself. I mean, not just the fossils, but the genomics.
I guess this is genetics, often what,
it's unlikely to be overturned.
Yeah. And I think this is where a lot of people would go, Doug, and say, you've got some interesting theories here, okay, but there's so much else in the fossil record, in everything else that kind of the genetic sort of, you know, the fact that everything looks like it's coming from common ancestry and so on. The weight of all of that you have to take into account, and you can't just turn over the evolutionary story in that way.
In the book, I refer to this mountain of literature. Okay, when I was scratching my head and thinking, is this something that I want to delve into, that I want to apply my career to? Referring to the mountain of literature that describes the living world in Darwinian terms. And I realized early on as a student that the mere fact that there's a ton written from the Darwinian perspective, and there is, doesn't validate the perspective. It simply is confirmation that this is the orthodox perspective. Everyone is working from this perspective. So I don't think that this weight of paper really is a weight of evidence. And I think Keith is really referring to a whole lot of paper, not a whole lot of evidence.
Okay. Look, we must talk about the theological implications of all this, because you're both Christians at the end of the day. And this is a conversation we might not be having in quite the same way if I'd got you on with Richard Dawkins or someone like that, Doug. But Keith, one of your worries is that this actually does a disservice to the Christian view of God, what Doug is suggesting here in terms of believing that these biological systems suggest that there has been some kind of design going on. In fact, you think of it not so much as design as tinkering, because it doesn't. So just tell me what your concerns are on a theological level about this.
Yes, I mean, the standard Christian view would be is that God is the sustainer and the upholder of the whole universe. Everything all the time, rather than actually just stepping in to tinker with various bits and pieces. The things that are there aren't good enough, so I'd have to step in and do something in order to alter what's already there. Whereas a Christian view is that God is sustaining the universe the biology, the physics, the whole lot, all the time. And we read that in all kinds of different places in the scriptures. Whereas I'm concerned that the intelligent designer is sort of stepping in every now and then to tinker with things that aren't good enough. And that actually implies that there are some things that are not designed. And I'd want to say that God's involved in the whole thing, not just in those right. specific instances where we're going to invoke design.
And in that sense, so that, what you agree that, in a sense, that in the big picture, God intended for humans to be here, and that we are there is, you know, but that he instituted the natural laws and the way that evolution works without having to be interfered with in any way as his mechanism
yes,
for doing that.
I don't want to invoke a God who just lights the blue touch paper and retires. That God is imminent in the whole of creation. Not just in little bits here and there, and certainly not just at the beginning, but that's along the sort of lines that I'm going. Yes, Justin.
All right, we'll hear what Doug has to say in response to that, because we're drawing to the end of this particular part of the programme. We'll have 5 or 10 minutes to conclude the discussion in a moment's time. Talking about Doug Axe's new book today, Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. Doug is a molecular biologist and director of the Biologic Institute. In conversation with Keith Fox, professor of biochemistry at the University of Southampton. Both are Christians, but disagree, have different views on whether biology confirms or contradicts Darwinian evolution. And we'll see what Doug has to say in response to Keith there, as to whether the God of intelligent design is too much of a tinkerer for us to take seriously. Do come back again for the final part of today's programme. Don't forget, you can find links to my guests online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. See you in a short moment.
In July 2016, Unbelievable, the conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with Jay John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the final part of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, presenter of Unbelievable. This is the place where we try to make good conversations happen every week between Christians, non-Christians and everything in between as well. We'll finish our conversation between Keith Fox and Doug Axe on whether design in nature is undeniable. Very much following on from last week's programme, where we asked, does new biology mean a new thinking in terms of theology? That was Luke Jansen and Fuzz Rana in discussion, and a lot of feedback to that programme. I think probably part of the reason we've had so much feedback on that show is because it was very much delved into practical examples of the human anatomy that Luke Jansen felt could only be explained in an evolutionary framework, and obviously Fuzz Rana pushed back for the special creation model. So we'll be seeing what you thought of some of those examples a little later on. Don't forget, if you want to find out more about Unbelievable, you can not only look at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and see the stuff there. You can follow us as well on Facebook and Twitter, at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow on Facebook. I try to post interesting articles and links and my own thoughts on various things across the course of the week. A number of the articles I post come from the magazine that I edit, Premier Christianity Magazine. And if you'd like a free sample copy of that, our new Christmas edition, our December edition, is already out, and you can get hold of that by asking for a free sample edition at premierchristianity.com/free sample, always packed with interesting features, interviews, articles, reviews, news, cultural analysis, and much more besides. Again, just a reminder that if you're listening after Unbelievable, you can hear the profile with Reverend Canon Philip Mount Stephen, head of the Church Mission Society. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And if you're coming back for Unbelievable next week, well, on the radio side, I won't be here. In fact, we're giving over next week, most of next week, to our regular fundraising appeal, Together Now. And so what you'll be getting if you're a podcast listener or listen online is another debate. David Wood and Michael Shermer were involved in a debate on the existence of God earlier this year, and that was hosted by Ratio Christi in the state. I've been given permission to put that out on the podcast, so you'll be hearing that discussion if you get hold of the podcast or listen online from next Saturday. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So as we conclude today's conversation, we've had Axe versus Fox, which is quite nice, isn't it, in terms of the names of both my guests, Doug Axe and Keith Fox. Molecular biologist in the case of Doug Axe and professor of biochemistry in the case of Keith Fox. And we've had a fascinating discussion so far, gentlemen, where we've ranged over the question of whether there is a sort of consensus opinion in science that militates against new types of theories about biology. We've talked about the science and the mechanics of proteins and amino acids and whether we can come to complex proteins via the traditional way in which people suggest evolution works. We've talked a little bit about whether design is an adequate way of understanding the biological world. And we've finally touched on the theological implications for God. And effectively in that last section there, Keith saying it just doesn't comport well with his view of what we would expect, the way we'd expect God to work. It seems like a messy tinkering, you know, oh, it didn't quite work. I'm going to have to go in and make sure that these biological systems do what I want them to do in the end. For Keith, I think that that's in a sense, it doesn't work with his view of how God would work in the biological world. He sees it far more, I think, elegant and neat to say, yes, God just used these very simple processes to produce something complex, you and me. Is that an argument at a theological level that militates against your position, Doug?
Well, it's being used to. I don't find that... I may not understand it fully, because when I first heard Keith use the term tinkering, I wasn't sure what he's referring to, because scripture refers to God creating, and it doesn't apologize for that, and it doesn't use the word tinkering or fiddling. So I wasn't sure whether maybe Keith was talking about an evolutionary process that gets stuck and then God has to reach in and change an amino acid here or there. If so, I think I agree that seems strange. Is that what you were...
Is that what you mean by the idea of God tinkering and having to mess around in that way, Keith?
Yes, I suppose a God who finds that things that aren't there aren't quite the way they should be and has to invent, maybe the miraculous has to happen because it couldn't happen by natural processes. I'd want to ask a more detailed question. If God is the designer, how is he doing the designing? If you're looking from the outside, would you actually see anything miraculous happening at any particular time? Or was it actually done by natural processes, in which case we're splitting hairs?
Well, okay, so there's two questions here. I think I would agree with Keith that if evolution were almost, if the natural mechanism that's been proposed to explain life were almost good enough, but not quite, and God had to reach in and touch something here or there, I think I would find that to be a strange view. I don't view it to be at all adequate. It's entirely inadequate. It's a complete fabrication. It's a false story that's been put in place of the true story. So I don't think the view that God reaches in and creates is at all in tension with Scripture, because that's what Scripture says. I think it's a strained view of Scripture that would say that in creating the elements and the basic laws of physics, God created everything, that everything else followed from that. So that would be, in my opinion, that's a strained view of, a strained reading of Scripture, a strange constraint to put on our interpretation of creation.
Because for you, as far as you can see from the scientific research you've done, these complex molecules, these proteins, had to be like that from the outset. You just don't get a kind of any evidence of this, of a story of gradual change and adaptation over time.
When you look at any proposed mechanism for how life could happen simply by physics making life, it doesn't work. That's what I'm saying. So it just doesn't work. And in a sense, you could bracket even the fact that we're Christians and asking how do we interpret Scripture in light of this, and simply look at the science. And I'm simply saying, if you look at the science, it does not work. So that's just a fact that we have to deal with.
I mean, obviously, Keith, you disagree that the cases against Darwinian evolution anyway. So I guess you have a fundamental disagreement there. I suppose very often these things split down, don't they, between the scientific evidence, the mathematics, and our intuitions about the way God would and should act in the world as well, Keith. And for you, it sounds like this isn't the kind of way in which you feel God would do things. You think there's something...
I think it's deeper than just the way I think God should have done things. Who am I to tell God how he should work? But it's the God that I read in Scripture, who is imminent and involved in all the processes all the time. And certainly not setting up from some form of a deism of a God who set the laws in motion and then step back and watch things happen. But in him, all things hold together. And that's not just at the beginning. That's throughout the whole of time. And I'm concerned about, if you like, the God who interferes with things. Well, you may be familiar with Newton and his planetary laws, had to invoke God as coming in to make sure the planets stuck in the orbits we observed them. Whereas, of course, Laplace said you don't need to invoke that sort of God coming in to change things. We can explain it through the physical laws. And that's where I'm concerned that we're seeing that with the intelligent design movement, of God stepping in to design specific things, some of which, to be honest, are unpleasant, as well as the pleasant things.
I mean, what you're describing is a sort of God of the gaps, then. But I guess your point is, it, Doug, is that, well, hang on, these it's the very physical laws that cannot explain,
correct,
this kind of type of complexity that you see.
Yes.
And therefore, it's not that there's a gap that needs filling. It's a gap that's been opened up by the science you've been doing,
right,
in that sense. The other flip side of this, of course, is that you may have a view that actually the Darwinian view of things has its own sort of thing that militates against a Christian worldview and so on. I mean, does that come into your thinking as a Christian?
Sure. So, and I think this goes, this is hand in hand with the history of Darwin's theory. And I just, we were talking about a Royal Society conference, 3-day conference here in London. It's clear, and I was like a fly on the wall in this, I didn't try to make any waves. It is clear that a number of influential people to this day in evolutionary biology do not want God to be to exist or to be a part of.
So you think there is an agenda?
There clearly is an agenda, because when the conversation went in certain ways at this meeting, people would get very heated and say, "Are you saying this?"
Right. Yeah.
So I think all through the history of this theory, there has been an agenda, and that is to replace God as the explanation for life and ultimately for everything. But the key problem was to explain how we could be here apart from God having put us here. Mm. And I think Darwin's theory is the answer to the atheist for that. And I'm not saying that everyone who holds it is an atheist, but I think it is a tool that has been forged for that reason, and it continues to be used for that reason.
So, Keith,
I think it's been,
yeah, final,
it's been
thoughts,
misused in that, yeah, sense. I mean, you do hear Richard Dawkins talking about evolution making him an intellectually satisfied atheist. But that, I think there's a fallacy in that. It's not that the evolution drives you to atheism. Science itself is compatible with atheism. Clearly, somebody like Dawkins is very satisfied with that. But it's equally compatible with a theistic view of life and of the origins of life. Doug is quite right. There are scientists who would go to extremes to get away from any possibility that God might be involved. But if we use the word science rather than naturalism, which is a rather loaded word that we come up with sometimes, the scientific process is observing the world that we see, constructing hypotheses, theories as to the why and how things work, which is what Doug is trying to do as well, and coming up with explanations without necessarily the need to invoke God within that. Now, of course, the Christian working in the laboratory understands that God is upholding the whole universe, and therefore we can't talk about it's naturalistic or not naturalistic. It's just scientific in the way that we observe things.
It's been great having you on the program today, Keith. Doug, I'll give you the final word. I'd be interested to know, do you think, you know, having been at that conference, being involved in this world, that there will at some point be the kind of revolution that you see in your microscope? Do you think that's going to be eventually recognized by the rest of the scientific community?
It's clear to me that this is not simply an intellectual thing, that there's a spiritual element to this, and that for a number of people, Darwin's explanation of life and the way it's been embellished has become a cornerstone for an alternative view of reality, and they do not want to let go of it. So I don't think that any evidence will pry that out of the minds of people who are determined to hold on to it. And I realize I'm not talking about Keith here. I'm talking about atheists who want to use an alternative explanation of life in order to remove God from the from the picture. It won't be science that, okay. that changes their mind.
It's been really fascinating.
Yes.
Thank you for coming in. Thanks for talking about the new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. Again, links to both Keith and Doug from the website today, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In the meantime, all the very best and a safe trip back to the States, Doug.
Thank you very much.
Keith, thanks for being with me on the show as well.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As ever, if you want to comment on today's programme, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I try to read out any relevant comments as well that come in via the Twitter, Facebook account, and indeed lots of people who spend time commenting underneath the latest edition of the programme. So if you want to go and do that there as well, see what other people are saying in regards to the most recent editions of the show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And while I think about it, do rate us as well on iTunes if you're listening via podcast. Why not leave us a review, tell other people about it as well. It always helps to spread things by word of mouth. Speaking of reactions to last week's programme, I'll read out a lot of the emails that came in and some of the comments as well underneath that show online. Rob got in touch to say, looking in your backlog for either of the two topics in my subject line, namely Old Testament reliability and inerrancy, I haven't really found any. Perhaps you try to put together shows in the future on those topics. For Old Testament reliability, I don't know who your atheist guest would be, but Timothy Michael Law or Emmanuel Tov might be good guests in defence. Perhaps James White and N.T. Wright for inerrancy. All just suggestions that feed my personal interest. Take or leave as much as you like. Thanks for the suggestions, Rob. We have done biblical inerrancy in the past. If you do really search through the archives, you'll find some stuff there along those lines. But perhaps it is time to revisit that subject. Rui from Portugal says, I'm writing to you to suggest a guest. I don't want to become a nuisance. I'll keep it brief. No nuisance at all, Rui. I'm always happy to look at people's suggestions. You've lately been insisting through several guests that Christianity had a profound effect on the morality of people in the West, changing the supposedly brutal ethics of the classical world into something closer to what's prevalent today. I think a great guest on this topic would be Richard Carrier, yes, the mythicist, who has argued repeatedly that there's nothing new about Christian ethics, being just rehashed cynicism and stoicism. Putting him on against someone like Tom Holland would be great, although it would break the usual format of the show by pitting two non-believers against each other. Thanks, Rui. I'm not necessarily averse to having two non-believers if there's a good discussion in it and where there's a point of contention like that at stake, but a good suggestion. Colin Mundy says, it was interesting to hear Tom Wright talk about the default religion in America being Gnosticism. It seems to be spreading to the church over here with many self-help books and a focus on mind and psychology. Are we becoming self-centred instead of Christ-centred? Perhaps an interesting discussion for your show. Thanks, Colin. I assume you are writing from the UK, given that. And here's a few emails relating to the Tom Wright and Tom Schreiner show. That was their discussion on atonement and penal substitution, those kinds of issues, on the back of Tom Wright's latest book, The Day the Revolution Began. Ray Chung got in touch to say, cracking programme, great guests, great moderation. Thank you. I don't think Tom Wright went far enough. Just my humble opinion. If he had, he might end more or less in the reformed camp, smiley face. Idolatry is going back not far enough. I think the root cause is a failure of faith. If Adam and Eve had answered the serpent's question, did God say, surely you will not die, with, oh yes he did, why should I trust you, a mere creature, then no idolatry would have taken place. I actually think that's why we're justified by faith. God could easily have chosen any other means, sacrifices, washing, pilgrimage, but our failure was failure to faith and trust. Our means of salvation is by faith and trust in Christ. Even that is a gift of God, so that no one can boast. It seems to fit so neatly. That's why I misappropriate the term supersymmetry. As an aside, this also calls into question Wright's notion that justification is primarily God's declaration that we are in the covenant. Bringing God's kingdom on earth is, of course, right. Conversionary Protestants have been doing that way before Tom Wright thought of it, but it narrows the gap of an infinite gulf to minuscule proportions of what God's going to do. If we think eternity, not in terms of 10,000 years, but more like 400 billion years squared, it puts Christ's gift of righteousness and perfection to us into far sharper relief. If we are just a smidgen grumpy, a teeny weeny bit selfish, over 400 billion years we'd be intolerable and we'd kill each other. Righteousness and perfection has to be imputed to us at huge cost. When I think in these terms, what Christ did on the cross was nothing short of stunning. Words fail. There is a quantum leap of difference between the kingdom on earth that Tom Wright is giving the impression and wants us to focus on, and the new heaven and new earth that the apostles write about. The whole universe is waiting in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. It will be stunning and tumultuous and glorious. Again, I don't think Tom Wright goes far enough. As Tom Schreiner hints, why should we not be excited about it? I am, says Ray. Thomas got in touch to say, it was with great interest I listened to the recent interview with the two Thomases. The meaning of Christ's death on the cross has been my interest for the past few years. I am, to much extent, inspired by the work of the now late French philosopher René Girard, who converted himself to Christianity, believe it or not, through reading literature as a tutor at Stanford University in the US. In one of his most important books, Things Hidden Since the Foundation of the World, he suggested so-called non-sacrificial way of reading the Bible. As you surely suspect, he proposes a non-sacrificial reason for Christ's death. He's a very popular figure. I can only refer you to the Wikipedia or about four Facebook communities devoted to his thought. Therefore, my question is, if you could look closer into the subject and invite into your studio a Girardian Christian and a typical one, I think the exchange between them could be very interesting and fruitful. Thank you, Thomas. And again, just quickly, finally, on N.T. Wright's show, Mike in Toronto says, re-downloaded the podcast, finally got the entire episode. Great discussion. I highly respect N.T. Wright, his scholarship and opinions, but I was disappointed with the answer to the Old Testament sacrifice question. From his answer and those of the Jewish experts he consulted, there seems to be no explanation for these God-given sacrifices, and therefore to say that the sacrifices are no longer necessary and in fact fulfilled because Jesus is the last sacrifice is rather meaningless. If penal substitution wasn't the purpose of the sacrifice, then what was? If they were not just copying their pagan neighbours, then what was going on, and what exactly did ancient Israel think they were doing? Okay, let's move to last week's programme. This was Luke Jansen and Fuzz Rana in discussion about various aspects of design in biology, or whether it's simply evolution, and whether we need to change our Christian theology in light of that. Very quick comment from the comments underneath that show online from David R., who said, in summary of the show, should modern biology make us rethink theology? Luke Jansen, yes. Fuzz Rana, no. Justin, closing remarks, the end. It was a little bit more complicated than that, David. This email from Tian Han Kam in New Zealand wants to say, firstly, fixes versus optimal design. Claims or presuppose that someone knows better. Like Fuzz said, and again, we can't think of a good explanation for certain design doesn't mean it has no function, and the bad design claims have backfired repeatedly. Are goosebumps useless on humans? The Greatest Hoax on Earth by Dr. Jonathan Safati points out, goosebumps are not functionless. They do make a difference, even with our small hairs, in trapping a layer of air. Also, the muscles help squeeze oil onto the skin. The hair helps stop the oil glands being clogged. The muscle contractions themselves generate heat, of which more can be generated by shivering. The whole process is called piloerection. Body hairs provide extra sensitivity to touch and also help in the cooling process by keeping perspiration in an even layer rather than dripping off. The fact that men tend to perspire more due to a higher metabolic rate is one reason that men have more body hair than women. You also take issue with the idea that the human tail is a vestigial organ and other things as well. The windpipe. We'll leave that for the moment, but thank you. That I think, as I say, the fact that these physical examples were focused on got people thinking. Grace in equally says, of course, goosebumps are useful, though the effect may be far less than for hairy animals. They still help us to retain warmth by trapping body heat. Additionally, a small amount of heat must be generated in the cold surface tissue by the contraction of the arrector pili muscles. These muscles also have a function in sebum secretion. So similar points here to the ones that Tianham Kam was making. Thank you, Grace. James Lucas in Houston, Texas. I'm going through some of the positive ones on Fuzz's side, if you like, and then we'll hear some of the response in favour of Luke's position. This from James in Houston says, as a new listener to the Unbelievable podcast, I've thoroughly enjoyed the content discussed over the past few weeks. I certainly align myself more with Fuzz's old Earth creationist model, but I appreciate Luke's thoughtfulness and thoroughness in arriving at his conclusions. That being said, a number of things I'd like to say in response to Luke. It seems his main point leading him to his conclusion of common ancestry was there are many examples of unnecessary components and poor design in the human body. These examples seem unnecessary or poorly designed to us humans based purely on our experience and understanding of biology. However, Isaiah 55:8-9 reminds us that God's thoughts are higher than man's thoughts. So approaching these examples from a purely human experiential point of view is, I think, a bit narrow-minded. Luke used the convergence of the esophagus and trachea as an example of what he called malevolent design, arguing an intelligent creator should have designed it differently to avoid the risk of choking. Similarly, I'd argue that if humans evolved from other animals and the evolutionary process is still ongoing, why would humans have evolved this feature in the first place if it was such a problem? Also, why haven't humans evolved to where the esophagus and trachea are structured differently to solve this issue? I'm by no means an expert in biology. I'm a mechanical engineer, but I just wanted to share my thoughts. Thanks for putting on such a great product that challenges believers and skeptics alike. So let's go to some of the stuff that was more critical of Fuzz's position and more pro Luke's position. Tom Rafferty in Charlotte, North Carolina says, excellent show. I have only a short and succinct comment. Given the clear information presented by Luke, I'm baffled regarding why Luke is still a Christian, given his support of present scientific findings that include that there was no pair that began humanity. Thus, no need for a savior. Tom says, I was excited to hear this debate, but there's an awful lot of things I want to comment on. They were all rendered moot by your guest Fuzz Rana's glaring cognitive dissonance. I was expecting someone with a PhD in biochemistry to understand how the scientific method works, but apparently not. Fuzz, and I quote, said, if we're committed Christians, we cannot discard them, doctrinal views, in light of science. This statement's rather interesting because he states quite clearly that if science and the Bible contradict each other, then the Bible should win out, which is an odd choice given that in Genesis, light is brought into creation 4 days before the stars are born, seemingly defeating this idea on the spot, but never mind. Well, I'm sure Fuzz will give you a reason why he doesn't agree with your reading there necessarily, Tom. But then barely 1 minute later, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, if we could relax our views on methodological naturalism, then there's nothing to stop us believing in biblical claims. I can't explain what an intellectually dishonest person he's shown himself to be. He should know that science cannot work without methodological naturalism, not because scientists are closed-minded about the notion of the supernatural, but because if we cannot test or prove something to be real, it can't ever be used as an explanation. Jeff Foley in Hillsborough, Ohio, says the discussion between Luke Janssen and Fuzz Rana was fascinating. Thank you for keeping the discussion on topic. Luke is grappling with a huge problem. Modern science is at odds with one particular interpretation of the creation narratives in Genesis. Fuzz made a few interesting comments. One is that he believes that the Bible's inerrant. He probably wouldn't admit to this, but what he meant was, my understanding of the Bible is inerrant. This leads to another comment about 2,000 years of biblical scholarship. At this point, your guests were talking about Luke's new understanding of the Bible. Nonetheless, theistic evolutionists often cite St. Augustine's belief that the creation narratives have allegorical meanings. If so, the Bible can't be used to say anything about evolution. N.T. Wright said that creation in Genesis is a temple story, a show which Luke J. Janssen or Fuzz Rana and N.T. Wright would be an interesting transition to theology in trying to reconcile science and the Bible. And Kevin says, last week's show was great. I thought it would be a simple or even boring rehashing of arguments we've all heard many times before, but I found it actually changed my opinion. I have a PhD in pharmacology and biochemistry. The question of common origins versus special creation has always been one that I likened to predestination. There are good arguments for both, so it's not a hill I'd fight hard on. But hearing Luke's arguments, a few of which were new to me, changed me to highly favour a common descent argument. I've always liked and respected RTB, but Fuzz was a broken record arguing a kind of design of the gaps and assuming all the biochemical artifacts will be found to have purpose. Not likely, at least not at the molecular level. The more one is familiar with these problems, the more one sees they are real problems. Thank you. I'd be interested to know what you thought of today's show then, Kevin, if that's your interest in area. I'm sure we'll get another full mailbag. Whew! A lot of emails. That certainly got you thinking. do look forward to your thoughts on this latest show. For the moment, I'm going to leave you, hand over to Charmaine Noble-McLean, her guest, the Reverend Canon Philip Mount Stephen, on The Profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And just a quick reminder of what's coming up next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, next weekend, actually, our radio side is very much focused on our fundraising campaign Together Now. But if you're coming via internet or podcast, I'll be putting something special out on the feed. So you'll hear a debate between David Wood and Michael Shermer on the existence of God. Until then, have a great week. See you next time.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.